Hello, this is Chaz from Quiet Speculation, and you're listening to the QS Cast. If you're a QS subscriber, you're hearing this as soon as it gets published. If you're not a subscriber, you had to wait a few days. If you want to listen to the podcast as soon as it's published, or you just want to know more about Quiet Speculation, go to quietspeculation.com/tour and check out everything we have to offer. Another vendor series, and we're welcoming Damon Morris of Card Kingdom. Welcome back to the cast. Love to have you. You're a great guest, and thanks for giving us your time.
Yeah, thanks very much. Excited to be here.
We're excited to have you back.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome back. These are always great casts. We're going to go as long as we can. And like all these vendor series, we kind of go through a number of different topics, and we just like to have the time with you, be as organic as possible. And, you know, everyone really does appreciate this, and you're one of the best in the biz. So really, we appreciate you carving out some time for us. Tarkan, also, we like having you here, too. So
yeah, thanks, Chaz. I appreciate that. Damon, it's awesome to have you back. Since last time, actually, just so for people that are listening, I had the pleasure of getting to come through Seattle and hang out with you guys. And
yeah,
I have to
yeah.
say, oh my gosh, I was absolutely blown away by you know, Mox Boarding House and the Card Kingdom store. I have to everybody listening, Card Kingdom, hands down, is one of the, I mean, it's one of the most epic and amazing sort of, I guess you guys kind of refer to it as craft retail sort of stores. I mean, I've never seen a store like it. It's like, but the best comparison I had was like if you take a kind of like a speakeasy combined with a library combined with like Harry Potter, and you kind of like smash that all together with gamers. I mean, it's really, really amazing. So how's everything going with the shop, and how's things going with Card Kingdom? I mean, it's been since last January. We chat, you know, we met, we talked mostly about QS stuff, but what's been going on?
Oh, we've been all over the place. The retail stores have been doing well. We continue to, you know, sell games, run events, bring in new players, you know, all the things the store should do. Online, I work a lot on opening the new stores, and that's one of my big projects is the store. Is the design of the stores, you know, overseeing construction, picking out materials, you know, making decisions on where everything's going to be and all of that. But like the last 2 years now, I've been pretty much solely online. So I've been kind of behind the scenes working a lot on pricing algorithms and our stocking and making sure that we're, you know, doing the best we can with all that. And we've been doing a ton of work on the website that nobody can see. So unfortunately, I can't show that off, but, you know, we're getting all of our tools for our employees up to snuff, and we're trying to get that done so we can get ready to start offering more tools to the public for how they buy cards, how they sell cards. And we're going to do a big push on that next year. So I'm really excited for that.
Cool. Well, I mean, I think when we last spoke, you had just switched over to the new site. Is that correct? I believe so, right?
Yeah. I feel like we'd been over there maybe 3 months, something like that. So we were still fixing bugs and, you know, making things work right, which I guess is an ongoing thing for a website anyway. We continue to do that. And since that time, we've done more to make the mobile site and the main site. We refactored that so they work together better and become one site, dynamic site. And yeah, we're just continuing to improve that and trying to offer new features and, you know, make that experience the best we can.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, it clearly seemed like, you know, you had just opened up, I think, the second location you were open for maybe 4 months when we had last spoke, the new location. So is there talks or discussions about, you know, continuing to grow, maybe having some more shops? Is that something that's kind of going on?
There's nothing official on that, but I just had my first meeting with basically my team here that does, you know, restaurant and retail, and a guy that helped me open the last store who works with me on, you know, various projects. And we're starting to talk about it. We're starting to talk about a third store and where we would like to do that. And, you know, right now there's no locations chosen. We don't have the money to do it saved up, but we're working towards that. So, yeah, I think we plan to do more, and I think a third store, hopefully we can get started on something next year.
Amazing. Well, I mean, to me, that would indicate that things are doing pretty well, I guess. So I'm curious then, does that mean the Magic's doing pretty well?
For us, it's doing really well. Yeah. I think the hobby as a whole is strong. I think Wizards is doing a good job of reaching out to different types of players and pushing the different, you know, formats. I'm very curious, like going forward, how things like the Arena, does that bring new players in? Does that work that way? We're really pushing new players. We do battle decks, rookie decks. We make decks for people that are, you know, $7 to $10 that people can buy, that, you know, get them into the game and try to ease that transition from I don't know how to play this game to I can play an FNM. I think that's a big gap in the hobby and something that needs a lot of help. So I think all of these things working together, store quality going up, people doing a better job in retail, people doing a better job online, I think all of that's bringing in new players and making the hobby stronger.
Yeah, that's definitely something that you all seem to have additionally done since the last time we've spoken, Damon. And, you know, even on that forefront, we've, you know, had Kelly recently in there. You know, Tarkan was also in there, but Kelly kind of sat down with one of the battle decks. We see content creators like Chris Van Meter sit down with them. So y'all have definitely have kind of given back to the community and kind of pushed yourselves to the forefront, you know, in this community with, you know, kind of partnering up with specific content creators and kind of getting the name out there as well. I know, you know, you all have had partnerships in the past, especially last time we've spoken, but definitely seems like you've expanded on that area as well. So how's that been working out? And I know you guys have a huge presence in the community, like you said, and kind of building the community, you know, in Magic with the battle deck. So has that been a huge boon as well?
Yeah, definitely. We've historically relied on word of mouth, you know, just like if you come into our stores, you order from us, you're going to get the best service, you know, in the business, and we're going to treat you well, and trying to make sure that everything is taken care of. And if we make a mistake, we fix it. And that worked really, really well for us. But we didn't do a lot of engagement outside of, you know, our walls. We were, you know, once you come in, it's going to be great. And, you know, we've kind of jumped into marketing for the first time ever. We've really jumped into, you know, forming these relationships. And we've been very careful about it. I want to make sure that we are working with people who see Magic the way we see it. Like, it's a game that's fun. It's a, you know, brewing decks is really fun. Playing with your friends is fun, and it should be fun. And really like the positive attitude of the people we're working with. I think that's a thing that is important for the hobby. And I really enjoy working with the people we do because of that. But yeah, it's been good. I mean, we're growing because of it and getting new customers and getting an opportunity to, you know, give them the best service that we can and showing them that, hey, yeah, keep shopping here. We'll treat you right. And the sponsorships just give people the opportunity to give us a chance. And I think that's really good.
Awesome. Really quickly, from Lockheed, an insider, there's a comment here. There was a rumor floating around down here that you were opening up in the Portland area to compete with Guardian Games. I'm assuming, based on what you were saying just now, that there is no basis to that rumor.
There isn't. You know, we've thrown out Portland as a possibility. It's the closest big city. You could actually drive there in a day. I would love to have a store in Portland, but we have no plans of Portland. Honestly, I think that the next store would probably be closer than that. I feel like that's opening a store is hard, and getting it off the ground and making sure everything is perfect is hard. And Portland's a little ways away. I don't know if I'm quite ready for that yet.
All right. Well, then there you go. Rumor debunked. Sorry.
So Damon, you were telling us just a little while ago about how you had been spending most of your time, you know, dealing with a lot of the core stuff with online, the online business. I'm very curious, you know, since I started using Card Kingdom, gosh, over 2 years ago, and since we spoke, there seems to have been a lot of growth in your online business. In particular, with our listeners in Quiet Speculation, a lot of our subscribers, you know, have really kind of pivoted and are using your, you know, your buy list service and sending you a lot of cards. Can you know how's your online business doing? And have you seen, you know, obviously it seems like it's growing. And you know what's been happening over the past year with that?
It has. We we up the quantities, you know, and as we sell more, we stock more, we're trying to buy larger quantities. You know, a couple of years ago, you might have noticed like, hey, Card King is buying three of this card or four of that card. And we're trying to make it easier for people in situations that are moving more cards. Like, yeah, sell us 50, you know, give you one place you can sell them and ship one package and be done with it. Trying to keep our buy list larger, right? Not getting overstocked on certain cards by having very tight pricing control so that we're always buying the cards that are valuable. Because last thing you want to do is sell your $10, you know, rare for bulk price, or you don't want to send it to two different places. So we're trying to do a better job of having a wider catalog. Then we really ramped up foils. That was something we never really did in the past. And we went after it aggressively and just, you know, we're going to buy all the standard foils. Now we're going to buy all the modern foils. Now we're going to buy the Eternal Format foils. And we just kind of ramped that up with a plan and just kept turning up to the point that, yeah, now we're always buying the foils and selling the foils. And, you know, especially us jumping into Commander, you know, we were always had a strong Commander following, but we didn't deal in foils, which was kind of, you know, in hindsight, a silly way to approach a business. But, you know, corrected that. And yeah, I guess the more you can do and the more you can offer, the more one-stop shop options you have to buy cards. And we pay aggressively, I feel, in the market. And I think we give people a good reason to be here. And we really worked on our grading programs as well. Like, I felt grading was one of our strong points. And for a while there, I saw complaints and I, you know, made sure I chased after that. And I want to make sure we were consistent. And, you know, we want to be fair to our standards because we want to make sure our customers are happy with the cards they buy as well. But, you know, finding that balance and really dialing that in and being like, we are grading this card consistently and correctly every time. And
yeah,
you know,
that's, oh, sorry to cut you off.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to cut you off. But, you know, insiders definitely use the CK buy list all the time. I use it myself numerous times and as often as I can. You know, we have a couple comments, you know, saying, you know, similar things that it is the best. But I was also going to, you know, second that you guys have been really more aggressive on foils, not only buying, but selling as well. Is that something that you feel that has been successful and you'll continue to do? Because, you know, I definitely stop at CK first, especially when it comes to foils now, because you guys definitely do offer really competitive prices on that front.
Yeah, we definitely plan to continue it. And it's, you know, it's still kind of in its infancy, but, you know, we've been doing it pretty solidly for a year now. And they're kind of locked into, like, I don't stock more than a certain number of any foil. And I mean, you can figure that out by looking at the website. But, you know, I pretty much stock up to 20 and do that. And if we got to the point where that wasn't enough and they aren't coming in and going out fast enough, we can, you know, consider raising that as, you know, we continue to grow. And occasionally that's not enough. Like, I have seen cracks in the program. Fatal Push foil was one of those where, you know, if I bought 10 a week and sold 10 a week, it was really hard to have a total inventory of 20, right? I would run out and then I'd have a bunch coming in, and I have some work to do around some of those items. But yeah, we're committed to offering those. They're Magic products. People are interested in them and we want to serve that community. And, you know, with that and being aggressive on those, foils are something that a lot of people don't pay enough attention to, and foil prices do fluctuate. And, you know, we can be at $15 on a foil and have none in stock, and everybody else can be at $15 on a foil and have none in stock. And people are scared to make that jump. And we'll be like, yeah, we'll pay you $15 and we'll sell it for $25. You know, will that work? And we try to find the market price and to unstick those things.
So I have a question since we're kind of dabbling on your kind of pricing methodology.
Sure.
Something that you know, there's a segment of our subscribers that are very, very interested in old cards and, you know, the reserve list cards. And there was we've had a lot of discussion in our forums about how Card Kingdom, interestingly, was paying really aggressive prices on things like Drop of Honey or, you know, any of these old cards that were, you know, I'm sure you're aware there was a lot of, like, you know, attempted buyouts and reserve list cards and whatnot, and Card Kingdom always seemed to be paying really good prices on them. I'm very curious as to what sort of went behind that, if you can kind of tell us. Were you guys thinking, okay, we're finding that there's demand here for these cards now? Were you finding that these cards were going through an actual organic price correction and you were kind of just kind of stepping up to meet that? What was the methodology behind that? If you can kind of explain it.
I will do my best. I don't speculate on cards like that. Because I don't know, I feel like you lose on that. And I try to follow the market. And if I bought that card and I sold that card and I'm running out, I will pay more. And I will continue to do so until it starts to sell more slowly and they're coming in more quickly. And then we'll drop the price on that card. So I just follow that market. And it's hard when you see these jumps, you know, the cards you're talking about, the Arabian stuff, the Legends cards, where, you know, if you're watching like an interest page or something where this card went from $12 to $25 overnight. And you got to take that with a grain of salt. You know, quite often you're looking at TCG player data and you're comparing, hey, it was a heavily played one yesterday and it's a near mint today. And, you know, watching how those fluctuations happen, especially on the low inventory items, you got to take all that with a grain of salt and do some corrections. But I'm willing to go to whatever the market deems the price is. If people are buying them up and they're going to 100 or 200 or going up 200%, you know, I'll dabble with that and I might get burned. But if it looks like they're coming in and going out, I'm just going to follow the trends in the market because that's the correct price to me.
And so based on, because obviously, I mean, to be frank, you were paying some of the best prices on these cards during, especially during the height of a lot of that pricing activity, buying behavior, you know, that lot of that flurry. And so, I mean, I don't know if you can necessarily go into this, but how successful has it been? And do you feel like do you kind of feel like these reserve list cards have kind of, you know, they've reached, it was time for a price correction, and a lot of these cards have gone up and are holding. So I'm curious, what has the end result of that been at this point?
I think they've slowed down a little. There was a lot of hype at the very beginning when they were climbing, and they've settled a bit. Some of them have come down. I'm trying to think of what the card was this morning. Didgeridoo, I think. And, you know, that one jumped to like $8 and then has dropped back down to probably $5, $6, somewhere in there. And, you know, historically, that card's not been worth a whole heck of a lot. I think that the reserve list cards, with the reserve list, there's not more of them coming out and they'll continue to appreciate. And as long as people are interested in them, the prices will slowly creep up. And sometimes people lose sight of them. There was not a lot of confidence in legacy formats, you know, after SCG kind of stepped back from them. Not a lot of local stores offer them. And, you know, people want a place to play if they're going to be buying these cards for decks. The collectors are still interested. Legacy still exists. And I see these cards going up, and occasionally there's these kind of massive corrections where, you know, they can get spurned by somebody trying to do a buyout, but that just kind of pushes them to correct to the right level. Because as they're not getting a lot of attention, they might limp along for a while, and then people have a realization. Somebody starts buying them, and then they start popping up, and they'll settle into a new price. So I think there's going to be a sustained lift in those cards over time. I don't see it growing at a really huge rate unless there's a format change or renewed interest or somebody supporting a, you know, nationwide tournament scene for them. But I think they'll hold, you know, to some extent, but anytime you have that rise like we did, there's going to be a correction and then it'll stabilize.
So I guess my question then, because this is the perspective that I held tonight, my question, this is a question that I would ask you. So reserve list cards over time, I view them as entering the level of almost like, let's take vintage, for example. The vintage cards are basically, I consider them to be almost like fine art pieces. Okay, we make a comparison. And sure. I think over the next 10 to even 20 years, I think the entire reserve list has the potential to kind of move into that era where they're strictly collectibles. To me, that suggests that, okay, if I'm looking at a card game that's been around for 30 plus years, and these are cards that can never be reprinted again, I don't see how any of these cards could be worth $1 or $2. I think there gets a point where paying $5 to $10 for a rare collectible for a globally played game, you know, that seems justifiable. So it seems to me, in my opinion, that these can only go up. And I know that not everybody agrees with that, but so I guess my question to you is, do you think that that's a healthy perspective to hold? That, look, these are probably the safest places to go, and they frankly are probably just going to continue to go up as long as the game continues to be around and is popular?
I guess I don't approach Magic cards with long-term investment strategies much, so I don't put a ton of thought into that. I tend to look at them as a commodity and, you know, a way to play a game. And I guess there are certain cards that are on the reserve list that you look at them and you read them and you're like, is anybody ever going to do anything with that card? Is it ever going to be in a deck? And yeah, I can see that, you know, the fact that it's on the reserve list pushing that up a bit. But I mean, at heart, I find that Magic cards are valued because of the way they function in the game. And okay. It kind of reminds me of like artist proofs. Like I'm in Seattle. There's a ton of Magic artists in this town. And when I used to work the retail store, a lot of times an artist would come in and be like, hey, I have artist proofs for, you know, I'm trying to remember one of the better ones I've had. But, you know, at the time, some $40 or $50 legacy card, like maybe it's the Abyss or something like that. And you're like, wow, that's awesome. And I remember, you know, just kind of not having seen them before, like, yeah, I'll buy some of those. If the card's worth 40, this has got to be worth 80. I'll give you $40 a piece for those four cards, because that's great. And then trying to sell them and realizing nobody wanted that card. yet there's only like 200 of them made. And why is there not a demand for that? And I think it's a strange thing. My parents were antique dealers, and I got into kind of a similar thing with an item from them. And I think it translates. And it was, they had an original photo from the session where they took the album cover for the Beatles album that had the Butcher cover, which was a big uproar. They pulled them all from the shelves because basically the Beatles were sitting around with slabs of meat on them. And it got put out. They all got pulled back. And those original albums, if you can get one, are extremely expensive. And they had an actual photograph from the session of, you know, that was taken, one of the original photographs. And while the album might go for, I can't remember, $40,000, they couldn't get $5,000 for the original photo. And to me, that was asinine. Like, how could that be? But people are after the collectible and how it applies to the hobby. And I have a hard time with it because I really appreciate original art. But yeah, it's not everybody does the same way. That was okay. Kind of a long tirade. I don't know if that actually means anything.
No, absolutely. I don't know, Chaz, what do you think? I mean, I think I sit on the other side of the fence. I think that it's tough because I don't know. I just think that like a dollar for a reserve list card, I just think these cards are going to end up being collectibles. And I think a dollar seems a little low. Now, I'm not saying that card has to be $100, but sure, I don't think anyone's gonna mind in, we'll even say 10 years, paying $10 for a didgeridoo because it's a relic from hopefully the game is still massively popular and has grown even more, and you know, it's a card that you can never get. $10 to me seems like fine for a cool collectible, right? I don't know. Yeah. That's kind of where I sit with it.
Yeah, Chaz, what do you think? It's always been a little bit of both, and we love having these, you know, especially you, Damon, your perspective on this and large vendors' perspective on this, because this is kind of almost like an annual thing now that, you know, these cards kind of go crazy. And I do think that the floor on a lot of these cards can certainly increase. Like you look at something from the dark or something like that, and it's like near bulk. And then you look at like a card from Ixalan is near bulk. And you're like, well, that doesn't really make sense because there's like a lot less of these. And it's just, it may be a bad card, but there's just not a lot of them. So if anyone ever wanted one for whatever reason, for every person that wants one, there's one less out there. So, you know, it's kind of like a give and take. I mean, there's really, you know, the folks that really want into this, and it's kind of like a smaller percentage of players, but, you know, they may be willing to pay more for certain cards and they may not pay more for certain cards. So it all really depends. You know, there was a stretch there that, you know, I had some of these reserve list cards and they were selling really well in this kind of frenzy. And then it kind of dies off for a little while, maybe next year or something like that. But they do end up selling for more, but, you know, slowly but surely after kind of everybody is, you know, over the frenzy kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
But, for me, you know, the reserve list kind of is its own thing now. Like it really shouldn't even, it's almost not even treated as like Magic cards. And, you know, we have one of our data analysts, you know, send me, you know, some data. It's actually kind of funny that, you know, I don't want to take away from the content, but just really quickly that not a lot of cards, you know, outside of like dual lands, not a lot of reserve list cards are like even played in Legacy. So it's like really just people wanting in and that kind of percentage of players that really adore these cards and want to own these cards.
There's definitely that. I mean, and even if it's not a reserve list card, or if it is, like you can look at a Gem Gin versus The Havoc Demon or whatever the Demon in Onslaught was. Like, that's the same card, and one is worth a lot, lot more. But, you know, they've reprinted. Let's look at Shivan Dragon. Like, a beta Shivan Dragon still sells for real money. You can get one for a quarter if you're willing to take another one, but there is a collectability to that, and I think that is tied to its usefulness to some extent. But there's Arabian Knight cards that, I mean, I can't give them away. Sandstorms or Her Jackals or, you know, some of these cards that are just like, yeah, people will buy them, but boy, they do sell slowly. And they're easy to get. And I don't know what the numbers on those are. It still surprises me when I'll get a collection in and I'll have Arabian Nights and be like, oh, wow, I got 50 Sandstorms from Arabian Nights. And you look at those like, and you forget, right? Like, oh, I'm going to look that card up. And it's like, oh, that card's not really worth anything. And those surprise me and always have. And I think there is a, like with most collectibles, there is this nostalgia to it. Like, if you remember when you first started playing and you had this beta card in your deck and, you know, it ended up being worth a lot of money, like, people want to have that in the future because it brings back that feeling and helps them remember that experience. And I think that pushes some of those cards really, really high.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I was just looking at your buy list, so and just looking from you know, a large vendor's buy list kind of confirms, like, you're paying pretty high dollar on a card of like Lifeblood. I mean, I don't know if that card's really amazing or not, but people want to own it. I've sent you reserve list. I've sent Card Kingdom reserve list some of these reserve list cards that have increased. So obviously there's demand for specific cards. I mean, are they all, you know, $50 Tarmogoyfs or $100, you know, whatever, you know, $500 Drops of Honey? No, but yeah. There is demand. And I think it will continue to increase, whether that's really a good thing, because I don't really agree with the reserve list. I think it's far past the point of being a positive influence on the game. It was a decision made a long time ago at this point, but, you know, it's not really treated like the rest of the game anymore. They're kind of like its own. It's in its own realm of like being collectible at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. They're Wizards is kind of a tough spot there because there's this, hey, we've said for how many years that we are not going to reprint the reserve list. And it's even if it's the right decision to reprint, that is such a hit to their credibility that, you know, they're kind of stuck with that. And I mean, to both of your points, like, well, I mean, how many of these cards are actually being played? I mean, do we need these cards? And yeah, I mean, some people might say yes. Like, if you want to have a thriving vintage scene, then yeah, we would need those.
Certainly, but, Commander. At this point.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there are real benefits to that. And I think they've snuck around that a bit with functional reprints. But, you know, can you really do a functional reprint of a Mox and get away with it? You know, that doesn't seem to.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they get very close, and I think that's really all people can hope for. I mean, growing rights of Iklamok is like the closest thing you'll ever get to a Gaia's Cradle reprint. You know, Mox Opal is the closest thing you'll get to a Mox. So, you know, they'll get close, but I mean, it's kind of just gone on for so long that it's just not going to change now.
Yeah.
I don't think people should be expecting it to.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I just think they have so much in stake of their reputation by saying one thing that switching now would be very, very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. I just think that it's credibility. And I think it's sort of, again, I think from the collectability aspect, it's the one area, it's like they can push a lot of boundaries and reprint, you know, they can reprint, you know, Liliana of the Vale or Tarmogoyf a million times. And they can really kind of knock the value down if they really wanted to. But they kind of have this little patch of cards that they've just kind of set aside that for just, it's kind of like a gift to collectors, like a thank you to collectors. You guys can have this segment of cards that, yeah, maybe some of the prices for some of these things end up getting kind of crazy, but that's, you know, that's our world where we just have some collectibles, you know? That's what I think. Yeah. But let's pivot, Damon, and let's get to new cards and talk a little bit about Ixalan. That's cool.
Sure, yeah.
All right, so... there's been so much hype around Ixalan, to the point where at HasCon, we had heard that that actually Card Kingdom was opening a significant amount more of Ixalan, which you can confirm or deny that. that's a rumor or not. I'm curious. You more than probably anybody can tell, better than anybody can tell us, how's Ixalan doing? Did it live up to the hype? Are the numbers looking good? Did you guys end up cracking a lot more? How's it been?
And Hopefully there's not an opening at CK at the end of the day.
So. No, everything's good. We did open a lot more Ixalan. We've been steadily increasing our opening. You know, we've been growing a lot this last year, and we've ramped up. And Ixalan, yeah, we decided we wanted to have the cards in stock, and we were tired of running out of things, and so we bumped it up. But we also, I mean, to be frankly honest, we may have made a slight calculation error in a mythic rarity occurrence, which we knew the correct answer, but one spot and one spreadsheet for one card did not get properly updated. And so we oversold our Carnage Tyrants. Let's just say that was our chase mythic for the pre-release. And so we opened up a few extras. So yeah, we had a significant increase in the total number of boxes we opened. But it's been good because the set's been selling really well for us. It's an interesting time because we had the World Championship, you know, so quickly after, but the Pro Tour is so much later. And I don't, you know, the decks that we first saw didn't have a lot of Ixalan in it. I was a little surprised. I thought there'd be a little bit more making its way in. And I'm super curious what happens, you know, over the next few weeks, like when we start seeing the pros playing decks, like what that change is. It wasn't a lot of time to get ready for that championship, but you know, I still expect to see a little more. So I think the verdict's still out on the set, like what kind of impact it'll have on Standard. That's really what's going to push this as a set. But it is selling really well for us, and it appeals to a lot of different people. We have a lot of cards that are, you know, the Vanquisher's Banner for us has just been dynamite. Like I can't keep that card in stock, and I'm really having a hard time. And I'm sure you guys are selling a bunch to us because we're paying really well on it. You know, I don't know that fits into Standard. It doesn't feel like a Standard card, but, you know, maybe they've pushed the tribal hard enough to make that work. But yeah, across the board, the set's selling really well for us.
Good. So, I mean, there was a lot of hype, and there's been a lot of questions. You know, a lot of people saying, it's not doing as well as people thought it was going to do. And some people are saying, oh, it's doing amazing. I mean, can you know, compared to, like, we'll say, Auer and Amonkhet, is Ixalan sort of like blowing those away, or is it, you know, is it doing marginally better, or, you know, how's it kind of doing comparatively speaking?
I think it's in line. We have a benefit right now. I think it's, if it was not doing better, it might not be a better set because our Standard format changed so much. I mean, we rotated out five sets. And so therefore the number of cards that are playable shrunk so much that Ixalan should be making an effect. It should be a larger part of Standard than you would expect. And I do believe that we're seeing that across Standard. Like, Standard has been really, really active for us this last month. Like, really active to the point where you could see the shift of people that would normally buy Modern cards buying Standard cards. And, you know, everything from the lands, you know, we're having a hard time on Spire Bluff Canal right now, or Concealed Courtyard, or, you know, there's these cards that you would think there'd be plenty of them out there. It's just like, they're just ramping up. And I think people are brewing with it because there's so many possibilities when you move that much stuff out, unless, you know, energy just beats everything. But yeah, the energy stuff's doing really well. Some of the combo stuff, Panharmonicon's still selling really well for us. Cards that bridge the formats, you know, Fatal Push is still extremely strong for us. We just keep selling it, keep selling that card. But yeah, it's interesting. The one thing I do notice is that people are really working on answers. I think cards like Scarab God are really pushing people to, like, how do you exile a card? You know, the cast out, which I just, as soon as I saw those God cards, it's like, cast out is going to be good. Cast out is going to be good. And it continues to be good. And we've got some other cards now that are really, you know, good answers for, you know, gods or these indestructible creatures. And yeah, I don't know how it's all going to shake out. Still interested if, you know, Merfolk or dinosaurs or, you know, pirates make their way in. I think there might be an opening for tribal for the first time in quite a while.
So you've seen an uptick then in like, well, it sounds like you've had uptick in Standard players. So Standard, for at least from your vantage point, is pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'm finding
definitely
this
turned
does
around.
Happen. Yeah, Standard is. I'm really curious how it's going to go. I mean, the format's not super diverse right now, but it could be. And I think we find, you know, quite often people are just kind of following with the decks that they've been playing for a long time until somebody shows that it can be shaken up. And, you know, not every Standard set does that. But you, we also have to remember this is the first set in a block. Tends to be when the second set comes out, a lot of those cards get better. And, you know, the value will go down, as does, as, you know, a new set becomes opened and becomes available. And, you know, there's a very good chance that the next set pushes some of these cards in a different direction. And, you know, a few of these dinosaur cards are actually really, really powerful. And they might seem unassuming, but I'm trying to think what the scavenger, the green one is. Death Gorge?
The Death Gorge, yep.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like that card, like first reading that card, it's like, oh, it's all right. It's got a marginal upside. But, you know, I've been watching that card sell and I take another look at it. I'm like, well, you know, you're exiling cards out of somebody's graveyard. In format, that can actually be a big deal. And you're getting a bonus on top of it. And there's these synergies that I don't think we're seeing completed yet. And I, you know, that's a card I have my eye on. Like I've been seeing it creep up and I think people are picking it up.
Yeah. It's all about context, right? It's like it's all about what's good now.
Yeah. And I don't know that fits into, you know, existing decks or if somebody's going to come up with a new one and if that's going to be competitive. I play enough to enjoy myself, but I don't play enough to understand what's going to win, you know, on a competitive level. But, you know, watching the numbers, it seems like people are brewing, and they're brewing with Ixalan. They're brewing with a lot of these other cards. People are still looking at combo. People are still looking at aggressive strategies. You know, it's people are still trying to figure it out. And I'm kind of curious how this, you know, 5 weeks of the Pro Tour, you know, shakes out. Like, is that going to, you know, I don't know. Is it solved online before there or?
Yeah,
you know, shake things up again after, you know, over a month after the release.
It sounded to me like Damon just gave a subtle spec target there with the Gorge.
That's Gorge Scavenger. It's been one that we've talked about a lot. It's certainly a great utility card. And, you know, I'm with Damon as well. I mean, it's such a condensed card pool that, you know, while Kaladesh, I do kind of feel like the Kaladesh block is kind of like, is very... It's stronger than the other two blocks now. Well, Ixalan. Well, we'll get the second set of Ixalan here soon. But every block is still going to have a key role. Now that the card pool is kind of really condensed, so I do think there's still room for more innovation. But we will probably still see the energies and the Ramunap Reds of the format still show up in a big way. There are some really great answers. There's some not so really great answers. So we'll definitely see. I still think there's still time for another bump in standard and its popularity after the Pro Tour.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, yeah, it seems people are pretty hot on the red dinosaur, which I obviously don't even remember the name of. But
yeah, the Rampaging Ferocidon.
That's the one. Yeah. That makes sense because it's actually in a deck that's super successful right now and making that work. So it might be a while before we see something that's new or different. And maybe energy will have to rotate before we, you know, completely do that. But that's another thing that's really interesting is, you know, looking at how many uncommons are in decks currently compared to a few years ago. And I mean, it's strange to have an uncommon in standard over $10, you know, or at $10 with Fatal Push. And it's continuing to be that way. If you go back a year or two, we didn't have these uncommons that really push, and it kind of started working its way up with like Winding Constrictor and then into the Aether Hubs and the Fatal Pushes. And there's a handful of uncommons in Ixalan that are really strong, and blue seems to be a really strong color when you get into commons and uncommons. And I don't know if that's going to start pushing that direction or not, but it's worth looking at.
We're kind of devoid of a really chase mythic of a set, especially with a set, you know, without masterpieces. I mean, Damon, is that still ahead of us? Like a 20, you know, a solid 25, maybe even pushing $30 mythic, or is just Ixalan not capable of that? I mean, to me, it felt like it could have been, you know, Carnage Tyrant, although that's cooled off a little bit, that could certainly return. But even looking past that, like the Planeswalkers, I do know that Vraska has been moving fairly steadily. I know Byleth, even on your end, are still fairly competitive on that. It sounds kind of crazy that a 6-mana Walker could be up in that kind of upper echelon of price range, but is that like kind of where we're headed, or is there just something that we're not seeing?
Boy, it's box price tends to the value you get out of box tends to stabilize one way or another. For example, if we go all the way back to World Wake, where you had Jace the Mind Sculptor come out, you know, look at the other cards in that set, and nothing was selling for over $2. And there are some fantastic cards in that set. And that's just because you could just crack a box and get that and get your money out. So therefore, all the other cards were just very, very available. And I think now we're seeing a bit of the opposite of like the chase high dollar. We're seeing a lot of commons and uncommons. I mean, with Opt, you know, getting 75 cents a piece for Ops, and we're selling them fast. I mean, that's our fastest selling card in Standard right now is Opt. And, you know, you get a lot of commons. And if you can sell a couple thousand of that card, that makes a dent in your overall, you know, purchasing. It becomes as valuable as a rare or a mythic is, you know, to your overall box price because you get so many of them. So I don't know if that's part of it. It seems like the value is still spread out kind of wide. We aren't seeing this, like you said, like this chase card and everything else goes down in price. And that might be partially just, you know, waiting for this to have its effect on Standard. But, you know, if a card takes off, a card takes off. And if a card becomes ultra competitive and has utility in more than one deck and gets some play outside in other formats, you know, Scarab God, did anybody think Scarab God was going to be hitting $50 at this point? I don't think anybody would have guessed that 6 months ago.
No, not and, certainly not this high, and certainly not in a masterpiece set.
Yeah. And, you know, that card is hot and everybody knew it was good. I mean, when people looked at it, when it first came out, it's like, that card's good, but the value didn't take off. Yeah. It took a long $50
time. $50 good? I don't know about that.
Yeah. And you had the debates like, you know, which one's better, you know, Scarab God versus.
Yeah. We look back at that. It's like, well, that was kind of silly.
And it was like, well, the Scorpion God's not as good, but, you know.
Yeah. And the Locust God, like, that's insane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it just has to find a home. And, you know, long term, maybe the Locust God comes back up too. I'm sure those will find their way into cubes and Commander decks and modern decks for, you know, years to come. They'll pop in and out, but
I know it's crazy, still crazy to say, but I still feel like, I don't know, I think Jace is being really overlooked. It's just like those 3-mana walkers get everyone every time. It's just crazy to me that these cards dip below like $10 and then suddenly they're like $25-$30 and everyone doesn't know what happened. I think the only 3-mana walker that's ever not done that up until this point was like Liliana the Last Hope. I don't think that card ever did below $10. So at least we caught that one. But, you know, I think maybe Saheeli was like a special case, but it just feels like these 3-mana walkers get people every time. It's they come out of nowhere. It's like, it's good. It's a 3-mana walker. We'll pay it the respect it deserves. But, you know, we'll just kind of let it trend down, you know, below $10 and kind of forget about it. And then suddenly it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. The Planeswalker, the Saheeli, I always feel like maybe there's a secret code, you know, it was on the box cover and then we went to the next set and then the combo piece came out and, you know, could we crack that wizard's code of like, this card's going to be good in 6 months. And, I was looking at the Ajani Planeswalker and, you know, seeing that at like, you know, $3 or below and thinking, wow. You know,
yeah.
How did that happen?
And it's just weird to see those cards. I mean, I get it. It's in a masterpiece set, but sometimes you just look at these cards like, really? Like less than $5? I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking on it, Johnny, like there is like if sets go a certain way and that card could have legs. I mean, that card could be in a top tier deck if certain things happen, which, you know, has not happened yet. Yeah. But
again, it's all about the context.
Yeah. But you know, we still have, you know, token strategies. People are still really watching those. The Anointed Procession, like that card has been hot, like really, hot.
Legion's Landing
has been, yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about what our hottest cards over the last week or so for Ixalan, you know, Legion's Landing has been really, really hot.
You sure there wasn't an against the odds in there somewhere, Damon? That's why it's like us.
That has an incredible effect on us. It's amazing. I would say that about Vanquisher's Banner too. I believe that was in a Goldfish deck just recently, but we were having a hard time with that card before that. So, I do have to look at that effect. You know, that does a great job of making those decks look fun.
yeah, for sure.
Damon, we actually have a couple of listener questions here that are pretty good ones. You know, they're pretty good questions, so I want to lob them at you if we could. First one, actually, a couple of these come from Efren, who's a listener right now. First one is, can you tell us about the supply of iconic masters? In particular, how it's looking compared to Modern Masters 2017?
I think it's going to end up being very similar.
I think we have our allocations in for like our first wave, and hopefully there'll be some more coming a little after, so we can keep doing drafts and in-store things. But yeah, I feel it's going to be probably very similar to other master sets.
These should stick around for a while, is what you're saying? Because I mean, it only started ramping up in Masters 2015, and then Masters 2017 was pretty readily available. So you think it's along those lines that there's going to be a healthy supply of this set?
I think the demand for it's going to be a little lower than a master set.
Okay.
I feel like Wizards has been scaling back their second printings of specialty sets, which you'll like nowhere is that more obvious than Commander. You know, Commander 2016 and 2017 just dried up and were gone. And the master sets, I see they're kind of going towards that same model. Like they'll do the first print and try to meet the demand, and then you know here's a little something to get you by for a while after that. But I think they're keeping that. I think they overprinted in some of the early master sets. I can't even remember which one it was. There's one that was couldn't get, was really hard to get, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere came a flood of it, and prices just dropped through the floor. And then you know once those were gone, they shot up because everybody sold them cheap, and it created a lot of fluctuations in the market. Iconic, I feel like, because a lot of the cards don't have necessarily that slot. You know, there's the modern legal cards that'll do great, and some of them are not. So it's, I don't know that it's going to be as popular as a Modern Master set. So I feel like the supply might last a little longer. That's my feeling.
Yeah. Also a question, what is the restock status of Commander 2017? Now, you kind of just mentioned, has that been steadily drying up?
We sold out immediately. We didn't even make it to the release. We sold out during our pre-sale. We didn't have any more sealed. We cracked a few just to supply that, but you know, try to buy that on the secondary market so that we can keep supplying the sealed product. And then we just restocked, I think last Wednesday, we got a restock back in. So we've got the sealed product back in. But you know, that I don't know if that's just a one shot, like here's a few decks and then it's going to disappear, or if they'll, you know, keep dribbling out of distributors. I'm not sure.
Have they all been selling very successfully, or has there been one that sold more quickly than the others?
Oh, it started off with one selling much more quickly. I can't remember how that all, but okay. One was really hot, and then as that one ran out, a second one got really hot, and as that one ran out, the third one got really hot. They were all pretty solid, actually. But yeah, I can't recall which one. You know, it basically just translates to, hey, which one's got the most value,
right,
for single cards. It they almost always follow that. They tend not to be about playability or about any of that. It's the market drives the price for the singles.
Definitely. So you did get a restock. Now you have no idea if there's going to be more after that, or
I don't. Those are always, you know, you can place your order every week and see what you get. Some will come out of Wizards from, you know, directly from Wizards, and they'll dribble out for possibly a little longer. Or sometimes the distributor will just sit on some and, you know, try to keep them coming into stores. And you don't get insight into, hey, is somebody sitting on a pile of this or not? It's just, you know, we get what we can and we sell it as long as we can and try to follow, you know, to give a fair price and, you know, make our money on it. But you know, we tend not to gouge, and we tend to just, you know, when it's gone, it's gone. So that's where we are on Commander. It's 16 dried up very quickly. 17 dried up more quickly. There might be more coming out, but you know, there's no indications that there's a flood of it.
Okay. The last question was, could CK, let me rephrase this. Is there any plan for CK to allow combining shipping on pre-orders? As well as offering in-store pickup for pre-orders. These are coming from insiders who use Card Kingdom's online service.
Oh, we do offer in-store pickups for pre-orders. If you just place a pickup order like you normally would, and for the pre-sale products, and just come pick it up after the release. So that's that's easy to do, can be done. For combining, I would actually love to be able to do that. Combine shipping. I'll take that to dev maybe later today and see if I can get them thinking on that. That'd be great for us in a number of ways because it simplifies the packing the order, the shipping the order. We aren't paying extra shipping. And you know, good for the customer too. So yeah, I think that would be a great add. We've talked about it, it's bounced around, but you know, now that I hear somebody in the world saying, no, I'd actually really like this, I can try to push that a little harder.
And this is from a few people.
Yeah. This is why insiders should tune in and ask questions in Discord, because here's what happens. You have Card Kingdom saying, absolutely, we'd love to do something like that if we can. So
there you go.
There you go.
And one of our insiders apologizes for buying all your Carnage Tyrant.
Well, I hope they work out well for you.
They really apologize for that.
That last day, I was, you know, my daughter had a school play and I was getting ready to go to it. And it was just all of a sudden like, oh, we have to crack some more. We got to get the Carnage Tyrants. You know, people are in the store picking them up and like, we have to have them. Like, So I did manage to get most of it taken care of before I left. I caught my daughter's school play. Everything was good, but boy, it was a.
Does that still like it, that? Still seems so fascinating to me sometimes. Like, how does that hit you? Like, you're really sitting there. You feel like the text come through or the notification. Like, Damon, we need you. We need more Carnage Tyrants. Get in here quick. We need to crack more boxes. We're fresh out of Carnage Tyrant.
Well, the funny thing is that, like, I still love helping with the release. I love getting their packs and sitting around tables. And, you know, and this was like the first release of like, you know what, Damon, you got plenty to do. Don't even come in. You know, it'll be great. And then as the release started ramping up, it's like, wow, we have a lot of orders. We got to get a lot of product out. It's like, maybe you come in for one day. And then the next day it's like, you guys need some help? Like, yeah, we need help. So it's fun. I like it in there and doing that after, you know, cracking packs for a couple days for really long hours, you do get a little tired. And but they do a fantastic job. There's a ton of work. It's a lot of organization. You know, we try to get every pre-sale order out on Friday. I think we do a fantastic job of that because, you know, we want people to start getting their stuff in the mail on Saturday. You know, we want it to be showing up. And
sure,
it's a big deal. Two people, like, you know, there's a new set. I want to play this new deck I've been brewing and I want to play it right away. And, you know, that's something we want to offer the customers. And it's something we can do. It's a lot of work, but I think it's one of the ways that we can offer a better service.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So how about we talk about some, let's move to digital, Damon. And I'm very curious to hear what you think about Magic Arena, because we've had some really interesting conversations. We actually had Nathaniel Buckley Wright, who is the CEO of Card Hoarder. I don't know if you're familiar with Card Hoarder.
I am. I just met Nathaniel for the first time recently. So yeah, fantastic guy. Very cool. Like him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He came on. We had a lengthy conversation because, you know, that's his world. So I'm very curious about what you think. Particularly, he made a very interesting comment, which was. He has a very minority perspective that Magic Arena potentially runs the risk of severely affecting the paper market. And so I'm curious about what you think about the game in general and also what you think about its possible effects on paper.
That's an interesting take. It could, I suppose there's a scenario. I don't see it affecting paper negatively. I see it as, I mean, from what I've read, I see it as a easier way for new players to get into the game.
That's exactly how I view it.
Same.
I don't know if it's, you know, the long-term plan and how that all works out, but you know, I mentioned this earlier, getting somebody from, you know, I've got a swag deck that I picked up at the local con with 40 cards in it to I'm going to play it at FNM is a steep learning curve. And anything that you can do to offer somebody a way to figure that out in a safe environment, like, you know, in their home where they're not going to feel embarrassed is a good product. And they've done some of that with Magic Online with the, like the Planeswalker decks. And, you know, I've heard various things from people about how bad that feels to invest $10 and never be able to do anything with those cards. You know, I look at this like, hey, $10 and I got to get pretty good at Magic so I could play an FNM and feel good about it. I think that's a fantastic way to go about it. But Arena just seems like a good way to bring new people in. It kind of reminds me of what they did with D&D, you know, back in the day of like, you know, making it very accessible so that people would sometimes move on to Pathfinder or sometimes stick with D&D. But Wizards definitely tries to find ways to reach out to new players. And Magic is a difficult thing to do that with, and they haven't always had the best product for that. So, you know, how do they bring people in? If that's the purpose of Arena, then great. We get new people into the hobby. Hopefully they go into their stores and play Magic and there's more demand for cards. And there's also the, you know, if there's no trading or redeeming within Arena, it might cut down supply for paper cards. You know, you don't have the redeemable cards, redeemable sets that maybe that makes, you know, chasing after singles stronger. Maybe it makes it weaker because the supply is more difficult. I don't really know, but it definitely has some effects. I as somebody who doesn't do a lot of digital, and you know, I play personally online occasionally, but I don't, you know, I have no business interest in it, and I'm not exactly sure. I haven't thought a ton on it. I've thought a bit because, you know, these things provide challenges and opportunities. So I'm curious about it, but I'm not sure.
Well, I did get into the stress test that starts on November 3rd. I guess I'll let you guys know if it is catastrophic or not.
All right.
I will let you know.
But yeah,
I think it's going to be an overall positive. I can't envision Magic ever going. I think if anything, it will stay similar to what Pokemon has been doing for all these years, where they have a paper side of the game and a digital side of the game. I can never see Magic. It's just, it's too complex. And they've kind of cultivated such a large player base with its paper side that it could never be a purely digital game.
Well, it's, you know, different people want to play it differently. If I have the option to doing a draft with my friends or doing a draft online, I'll do a draft with my friends. If I don't have the option to do it with friends, I'll do it online. And I think that's my preference. I like hanging out with people, you know, and that's the way I like to play Magic. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. So for me, like, I'm a paper guy. I sell paper in my business, and I know that there's the online option and I've used it, but I think it's just going to depend on the player. And if you have a really great online experience that people want to play, yeah, maybe that pulls some people over. But I think inherently the way you like to play it is a stronger motivator.
Yeah. So really simplify the argument was that, okay, you make a product that is really successful, which is obviously what they want. Now you have a large contingent of players who are not having to pay for Magic. Why are they going to turn around and pay $4 for a pack or $50 for, or, you know, $80 for a Tarmogoyf, right? When they can just play the free game. To which, you know, my belief is that you have to, like, there's a million steps, I feel, to get that point where you have the player base that's going to pull away from the paper, you know, the paper audience to that level, I think. I think exactly like you were describing it, where it's going to be kind of like Duels of the Planeswalkers was, where it's an updated and current way for new players to kind of come in and experience the game and kind of port them over to paper or port them all over to competitive digital Magic, which I actually think Magic Online is also going to exist in parallel. I don't think Magic Online is going to go anywhere anytime soon. Although that's another discussion of, well, you know, is Arena going to replace Magic Online and, you know, and all that. But I envision that most likely what happens is that there's Arena, there's Magic Online, hopefully updated, and then of course there's paper. I think all three can live in harmony. So
yeah, and I mean, I haven't read all the articles or watched all the videos. I've dabbled with it, but you know, I don't know what that free service is. You know, there's plenty of free versions of games that are a very light and incomplete version of. So yeah, I guess once I hear that, maybe you guys know more about that. But if it's allowing you to play with certain cards and not with others, or with a smaller pool or in certain ways, then, you know, that's just a good way to learn and then to become interested in playing the more advanced game.
From the content and what we know so far, that Magic Arena will kind of focus on drafting and standard, but it has the capability of pushing that boundary if they need to. So they alluded to maybe making a new format where it's, you know, Ixalan forward or something like that. You know, they have said that they're keeping in mind what players are able to do once, you know, cards rotate out. And because if it's just standard, well, what happens to all those cards? So they did say at one point that, you know, And this is what I said all along, that the platform is definitely built from the ground up to be expanded on. So I do think it's one of those things, you know, it's for seasoned and new players. You know, new players kind of pick up this kind of Hearthstone style digital game that they can easily get into Magic and kind of go from there and start playing in paper. Or it's for the seasoned people that, you know, don't want to drive, you know, if they're LGS, not every LGS is close by. They don't want to drive, you know, 50 minutes or 45 minutes that particular night. They can just jump on and play Magic Arena. Or, you know, if they're on a budget and they don't really have the $15, but, you know, can spend 200 coins or whatever the in-game currency is, or something like Hearthstone, where it's fairly inexpensive to draft, they can probably go and do that.
Yeah. And I mean,
it's something that needed to exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And the paper Magic seems to me a really good business model. And I don't know why they would want to get out of that. And I don't know why they would want to replace it with a thing that was completely free that they made no money on either. You know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So if people are looking for an option to play for completely free, and Wizard supplies that and it gives you everything that you could possibly want, I don't know how that benefits them. So
the model is free to play, but there's like microtransactions, small like cosmetic upgrades, or you know, you can pay for certain things, but the there's no cost barrier to actually enter and play the game. Now, that kind of situation. But yeah, time will tell. And I hope to get into the beta. I know Chaz was lucky enough. He's going to have a chance to get in and play and can talk about it. But I hope so. But yeah, I think that all three are going to be able to live kind of in parallel. I think this is going to be a benefit. Hopefully this translates to a benefit to Magic Online, in that I hope this, you know, spurns them, kind of motivates them more to make the improvements we've all been kind of waiting for.
I'm sure. I mean, I don't know how long they've been working on the arena, but I can't imagine that they don't have, you know, the plan to update the Magic Online to be, you know, somehow consistent or to improve on that as well. Right. They've got a new CEO who comes from more the digital world, and, you know, I can't imagine he's not itching to make this a good experience for everybody.
Damon, I want to kind of visit something we had talked about last time we had John, which was, you know, I remember we asked you the question, if I was a guy and I was listening to this podcast, I said, man, I want to open up the next Card Kingdom, and I wanted to go out and start a brick and mortar from the ground up. Is it still possible? Last time you had said that you think it's still possible, and just, you know, with as you continue to grow and you scale and you have new experiences in the industry, is that still a dream that's attainable these days with online, you know, online selling just becoming more and more, in e-commerce really kind of becoming so powerful? Is that still possible? Can you still build a brick and mortar into something really, really powerful or large?
Yeah, I think you definitely can. It's retail has gone through a massive transition in the last, 15, 20 years. And there used to be malls everywhere, and there were kind of a gathering place where people came together, and there was a bunch of different stores. And as online competition has risen, retail stores that are based on either convenience can do well, like, hey, I'm on my way home and I need product X, I can stop in and grab it, and you're totally willing to pay more money for it. Or you can offer a better experience. So if you're going to open a retail store, you have to find a way to give the customer something they want, something that they're willing to pay for. If you're just going to have a store with shelves on it and boxes with games and people can come in and buy them and then leave and have no positive interaction, that's not going to work. You can do the same thing on Amazon, right? I can get it in a day or two. It's going to show up. It might cost me less money. Why would I go through that experience? But if you're going to give somebody something that they value, then they will come in and they will buy that game and they will, you know, take you up on your other offerings. I've built my business around giving people, you know, a full experience. Like, you can come in and stay for 4 or 5 hours and enjoy your time here. You can play Magic, you can play miniatures, you can play board games, you can have a sandwich, you can have a coffee, you can have a beer, you know, you can be there and do that. And that's my take on it. All I did is I thought, hey, if I had the game store I wanted, what would it be? And all the way down to what are the table sizes and what's on the walls, and, you know,
what are my food and beverage options? You know, it just reflects like, what do I think I would want? And I figured there's got to be other people that also want that. And that's one take on it. And I think somebody who wanted to do a retail store, just look at what you love. If you can find people that you know that would love that as well, they will probably, it'll probably work. But you have to go into it, you know, seriously. It can't be like, I want to get a discount on games and a place for my friends to hang out, play games with me. I think if you're taking that approach, it worked 20 years ago to some extent. But, you know, as the hobby has grown, you know, board games used to come out, you know, you'd look at your catalog and be, what board game came out this week? Now it's, hey, what 5 board games are coming out today? It's the hobby has grown immensely.
Yeah.
And with that has come more interest, more people are playing games, and the competition has elevated and people are giving a good retail experience, not just a good game store experience. And you have to rise to that level. Nobody's going to come to your place if you can go to a place that gives a better experience for the same price. You know, you have to look at what's offered. And, you know, we still have stores opening around Seattle. We've had a few really nice game stores have opened and done really, really well in the last few years. I need to get out and travel a little more and see how the rest of the country, but, you know, I tend to find what happens here happens in other places as well. So I think there's a lot of room for that.
I like that. I kind of like that more positive perspective. There's a lot of, I think that there's a lot of, no. I think that there's a lot of, how do I say this?
Negativity.
There's a lot of negativity, but I think the thing is, I think it's unfortunate. It's justified to a certain extent because typically what happens is you find a lot of individuals, as you said, Damon, that kind of get into the store or the brick and mortar for the wrong reasons. They want a place to hang out. They want a place to get discounted product. They just kind of want to, they don't really know the steps, the practical steps to opening a business and treating it as a business. So I think that's what causes a lot of problems. But it's nice to hear the perspective that, hey, listen, if you approach this correctly, you can be successful. Chaz and I were on another cast recently, and I said, you know, we were talking about this, and we all kind of came to the same agreement that, yes, you know, if you don't approach this the right way, you could set yourself up for failure. But, you know, I really want to drive home the point that, all that said, you know, this is a business, and it's a very thriving business. I mean, I found that tabletop gaming, and you can probably attest this, Damon, just continues to grow, through the time goes on, just getting bigger and bigger. It's a viable business. It's a real thing. You have to approach it correctly. And I think that's
The mantra to me, you know, growing up, I mean, I've grown up in a family that, you know, have all, you know, gone off and done their own things and been entrepreneurs and opened up business. And it was always like kind of preached to me that like food was always kind of like the thing that people will always buy. And it's very quickly become, you know, added to that it's entertainment too. I mean, people, you know, will pay, you know, and to be entertained, and for their entertainment and their hobbies, they'll always find some wiggle room in their budget to go and spend some time, whether it be a movie theater or, you know, in one of these tabletop games, because you really just, you don't get that value really anywhere else. I mean, you said it yourself, Damon. I mean, where can someone else go for 4 or 5 hours and just kind of enjoy themselves for, you know, a fairly, you know, what you plan to put into it, whether it be $15 for a draft or, you know, you just buy a pack and hang out or something like that. Where else can they go for that? And a lot of the times, you know, people run into this, you know, they see, you know, what have you, YouTube videos, or they see these content where it's like, oh, you know, these people, you know, they just kind of hang out all day, or they're doing what they love. I get to just play Magic all day and like deal with like boxes and opening up boxes all day. Well, you know, there's a lot more that goes on beyond that you don't see. Like, what packaging are we using? How are we shipping all these thousands of orders that we get on our online store every day? How can we save, like, you know, 5 cents or, you know, 15 cents on a shipping across thousands of orders? You know, there's so many micro things that go on, that people don't see. And, you know, I've seen a large range, even, and I said this on the other cast that we were on, Tarkan, that I played the game a long time. I mean, I've gone into stores where you clearly know, a store owner and their staff is enthusiastic about being there and having folks in there. And there's a stores like you said, Damon, where you just kind of walk in there. you barely get any interaction. It's just like, why am I even here? I could just like order something on Amazon or something like that. So, sure. You know, those are the stores that will probably limp along. Maybe they make it, maybe they don't. But there's other stores that have been very successful and they're not Star City Games, Card Kingdom, or Channel Fireball. So it definitely can happen. It's just there needs to be a lot of effort that needs to be put into it, like anything else.
It does take a lot of effort. And, you know, you can't go into it with the idea of like, I love games, successful game store. It's like, I was an engineer. You're not going to be like, I like putting things together. I'm going to just go engineer. Or I like art, so I'm going to be a graphic designer. Like, you have to learn the tools and the market and how things work. That said, you know, if you don't know it, you can learn it. I mean, pick up some books on retail, figure out how to do the finances for the store, talk to people about distribution and how things come and go and profit margins. And, you know, are events important? Are they not? You know, there's tons of people to ask. There's resources on the internet. You can stop into stores. People are pretty friendly with this information for the most part. You know, they might not give you, you know, hard numbers, but they'll tell you what's important. And, you know, if you have the ability to put in the effort and learn the business side of it, and you care about the games, I think you'll be successful.
Now, let's take the having to be knowledgeable in market, and let's apply that to our kind of our hobby armchair speculators and our, you know, our audience that dabbles in the secondary market magic. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice would you give to someone who is either you're just starting out or is like, oh man, this, you know, this is so cool. I can buy and sell Magic cards, make a little profit. How would you, what baseline pieces of advice would you give to them?
Magic is unpredictable. There's reprints and there's plenty of things that if you're holding inventory can, from the business side, I look at, you know, as long as I'm turning it, I'll do okay. I don't know if that's always the best approach. I do know, like, I buy a lot from people that I can tell or, you know, maybe they're using online sets because it'd be like, I'm selling you these 5 rares and I'm selling you 62 of each one, right? When things like that happen, it's like, okay, you're just waiting for the cards to hit their peak and then you're, you know, selling them off. And maybe that's a really good approach. I've never even looked at that for our model. But, you know, watching how the market's adjusting and spotting where things are quickly moving, it seems like there's a lot of short-term gain to be had there. I've been noticing collector's edition seems to be very active right now and hasn't been for years. I think now's probably a good time to, you know, find the people who are still selling it low and sell it to the people who are selling it, buying it high. And, you know, with things like store credit and that, yeah, there's a lot of little things that you can jump in on. Masterpieces have been really hot lately and those seem to be climbing in value somewhat unexpectedly. I know they stopped printing them, but those, you know, I haven't been pricing those, but I've been looking at them like our stock on those has been surprisingly low recently. So, things are available. And my method is, you know, as long as you buy it and sell it, lock in your profit and keep going, you're going to do pretty well. When you do the big gamble, you know, you don't know which way it's going to go. So I'd make sure not to go too heavy in that direction.
It's a turn and burn kind of volume business. And Chaz and I, we talk about this all the time. I think every cast we get on, we always reiterate that we definitely adopt the turn and burn volume, lock in your profits. Don't wait, you know, don't wait to try and, you know, don't wait 6 months, try and make 50% on something. Just take your 10, 20%, you know, in a month and move on to the next one. Just keep reinvesting it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, people give me tips and I try to ignore them, you know. Nissa came out, you know. I got the tip like, buy all the Oath of Nissa. And, you know, and I watched that because somebody said that and it did get pretty low. And if I would have bought a bunch then and then waited, I could have sold them higher. But, you know, I'm not in the business of storing cards and I don't have a place to put them and I don't have a lot of interest in that. But I, you know, moving them is smart. Occasionally there'll be something that, you know, I'm all about the, hey, this is a cool card. I should buy a few of those. I actually speculated on Steam Flogger Boss. It's probably like one of the few cards they ever did. And then that was probably a terrible idea, but I turned it into
You ended up being one of the best buyers of that card when that all that hype went down. I think, yeah, I sold you like 20 Steam Flogger Bosses because you were paying like $2 or something on
them. I should have held on to them a little bit longer, I guess. But there's definitely those cards, and you can see them occasionally. We're like, well, this card doesn't have a home yet, but someday it will. And I think you just have to be careful when you get in. If you're buying that card when you're when it's at its peak and coming out and people are brewing with it, you're going to pay too much. You know, if it's not finding a home and it is undervalued, yeah, I think buying something like that and selling it down the road might make sense. Those things can be really hard to get, really hard to predict. You know, is this going to be viable in modern when it pays out of standard? And am I going to buy it in the middle of standard when it isn't getting play? That's I don't know. There's people that are probably really good at that. I'm not one of those people.
So then let me ask you a very kind of market specific question. This was actually asked, there was a Facebook group that I'm a part of. It's kind of a magic business finance site. The question was asked, Power 9, dual lands, or masterpieces, which will experience the highest percentage growth in the next 5 years? What would you say in your estimation?
Oh boy. When you say dual lands, which dual lands are you referring to?
We'll just say the basket. Let's take the entire basket of them. Okay. Because they didn't specify Underground Sea. So let's just say the basket of dual lands, the basket of Power 9, and the basket of masterpieces. Of those baskets, which group gains the most percentage points or grows the most by percentage?
I don't think it'll be masterpieces on that long of a time frame. I think they'll kind of settle in. And then those cards are, you know, subject to being reprinted in various forms down the road. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because I remember buying and selling duels, buying them for six and selling them for 10 over and over and over again back in the day. So when I see them at, you know, a few hundred, it seems so high. But yeah, I could say the same thing. You know, I remember buying a beta Black Lotus for 600 and selling it for 9 and feeling really good about that too. So,
well, let's kind of base it off of, I guess, what is Card Kingdom data? What would that reveal as far as like the trend here? Would that, you know, does based on your data kind of indicate duels or power?
I'd probably go power just because there's so little of it and it's so hard to get. And if there is a push in the market, you know, assuming reprint or assuming reserve list stays the way it is,
right.
And assuming that, you know, duels, there are those third edition options. And there was a lot of third edition printed. You know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of those out there. And when you get it to power, there just isn't. I'd probably say power, but just the playability of duels and how ubiquitous they are in, you know, the way people play. I'd probably go for power slightly over duels.
Cool. That was my guess as well. What do you think?
I'm kind of with Damon that it's just like power is so hard to come by. But I don't know. I mean, on your end, Damon, I mean, it might be harder for maybe, say, an individual like me to move power. Is moving power easier for you?
No, it's hard both ways.
Okay, so I think... It may be power is the raw percentage, but I probably still want a basket of duels over at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to make money and you want to turn and burn duels for sure, the margins on power is hard and the supply is hard and the sales are hard. If you could find, you know, low grade power, like if you can buy good condition power and sell it, like that'll move pretty well. But it's hard to come by. And then there's the collectors, you know, like if you get the really, really nice cards, there's people out there that want those. And it's, you know, people have that. I just want to upgrade my Mox Ruby. Like the one I have just has this little nick. Can I get one that has a little bit less of a nick, you know? And as soon as they can, they will push that and keep updating it. I think from a business perspective, the duels are just so easy to buy and sell comparatively. The power, you know, it has those fluctuations, has the weirdness, but like if you're going to put something in a safe for 5 years, I'd go power.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any, I mean, anything, it's kind of like we're getting close to that time, but I want to keep like having this conversation.
Yeah.
So I don't know, because I know you have other engagements, Damon, but is there anything kind of final thing? If anything, before we kind of wrap things up, there is a kind of a really great statement from one of our insiders to you, Damon, that they say they love, this is from Lockheed. I love this way the store itself is laid out and structured. I've been inside many times and I've brought people by and everyone has the same reaction. It's not like walking into a store, but more similar to a gift shop in a museum, they feel like they are walking into a community experience, not just a retail establishment. It feels really welcoming.
Oh, well, that's really nice to hear. Thank you for that.
I think maybe just because museum, you know, gift shops are always so like nice and clean, and well, the rest of the museum, you're kind of like.
And I love the old aesthetic, and I mean,
sure,
Tarkan, you've been into the store. The cafe in Ballard in Seattle is very much Art Nouveau. You know, it's like the old time French design, and I absolutely adore that. And I love things that are, you know, old and brass and metal and wood, and you know, getting artwork on the walls and having stuff from local artists done that accentuates the experience. Like I think, yeah, that museum experience might be what I'm going for. If you go over to the Bellevue store, it's kind of the same thing, but we went with a little bit more of a deco feel. And I have a library private room that I actually found. Somebody had a bunch of old law books they were getting rid of, and a couple of guys helped me out with it. I didn't actually load them, which I feel a little bad having them do that, because there's like the fourth story of this kind of grain elevator building, and they had to form some sort of slide to get them down and get them onto the moving truck. And then I helped move them in and put them on the shelves. But, you know, we actually made it look like a 1920s library. And I love being in that room and having that experience and playing games in there and just being surrounded by old books. And like, you get the smell and the feeling, and the lighting's nice and low, but the table's well illuminated. Like, it's just, there's something to that experience. And that's what I start with. That's what I lead within a business, is not, you know, how much is it going to cost and how much money am I going to make? It's like, how can I give the customer the best possible experience? And the best way I can reflect on that is to say, what would I like? And then ask other people and try to bring them through that and create that. And, you know, like I'd said earlier, the last couple of years I've been mainly working online, and I'm trying to make that happen online as well. Like, I can't turn a website into a museum, but I can make it, you know, reach out to the community and have better relationships with the people that are putting positive comments into the world. And I can try to make things easier for people on the website, so they enjoy selling cards and buying cards, have some tools that help them with deck building or help them with, you know, bulk selling. And, you know, those are the kind of things I want to get to.
Well, I mean, I think it's the level of detail and craftsmanship that you and your team have put into the store. I mean, I can't really describe it in this brief amount of time. I'd have to send pictures and talk. I mean, to the audience, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, you guys have that kind of like speakeasy secret room that you literally press, you press the button and it opens up, the wall moves. I mean, literally, guys, it's absolutely incredible. It's kind of like, just max out the vision of what a game store could be, and then kind of bump that up another half step. And that's what the stores are. And I mean, it's just, Damon, I have to say, it's a testament to you guys' attention to detail and the craftsmanship. I mean, it is really kind of, you guys kind of treated it like a piece of art, I have to say. I mean, it's really, really amazing what you guys did with the stores.
Yeah. I love doing it. And I love just finding ways to make it unique and personal and interesting. And there's something to adding enough small details that even if you've been in the store for a year, I want someone to come back and see something new. We used to have a puzzle room in the Ballard store, and it got converted to seating for the restaurant because really that was more important. But I had put together jigsaw puzzles, and it was those big ones, you know, they're like 3-4 feet across and 3 feet the other way. And, you know, they take a really long time. And I remember that being the biggest, most pressing detail to finish up before we moved into the store, was getting those puzzles put together so I could hang them from the ceiling, because that was the only place I could really put them. And, you know, was a customer walked through and stopped me and said, you know, I'd never, ever seen those puzzles on the ceiling there. When did you put them in? And it's like, that was before we opened, you know, and that was 3 or 4 years into the store, and just like loving those details. Or our chandeliers in Bellevue have, you know, 20-sided die instead of, you know, crystals on them, that, you know, I have to apologize to my coworker, Tim, for having to drill out 20,000 D20s every time I bring that up. But, you know, those little details they're fun and they're interesting, and they're just, you know, I like having those little discoveries, and I think that just contributes to the overall vibe.
Awesome. Well, Damon, I have to wrap up with the same question that I asked you, the last question from last time. And that is magic is Magic healthy? Is it growing? And is the future outlook for Magic a positive one?
I think yes. I think it's growing. For us, it's going very well. The positive outlook, I think the products are speaking for themselves. You know, they're fun to play. They're interesting. We're getting support for multiple formats to help different people play and keep them interested. You know, the Commander products have been really great for, you know, helping with supply for hard to get cards for some of the older formats, as well as, you know, getting interest in Commander out to the masses. And that segment's been growing a lot. I think there's a lot of positivity in the in more of the content that's out in the world. People like you guys and the MTG Goldfishes and the Professor and Command Zone and like Magic the Amateur, and like these people that are really bringing a positive lens on the hobby and helping people along and giving support and, you know, changing it from, you know, if you go back 10 years, there were really great experiences, but the whole market wasn't as positive as I believe it is now. And I think that's helping to bring new people in and helping to grow the community. So I think people are doing a great job in multiple aspects of it, and it's being supported by the manufacturers. And I think it's up and to the right.
Awesome. Well, Damon, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you guys. For
coming on. This has been fantastic. We always love having you on. I know you have a feature that you're working alongside QS with, and we will get you back here soon. I know it's really quickly like a buy list feature that you want to make. You want to make it really easy for folks to make a buy list with you all. So we'll have more on that soon, but we'll definitely have
I'd love to come back on and you know, talk about that and get feedback. You know, what are the things that your users would like to see? Because, you know, I do my best to go through the experience and say, hey, what can I give to people? But if I hear, hey, this is really annoying, and I know we've had those things in the past that have been, you know, just some of them are tiny things, but, you know, if I can get that feedback, then I can fix it for people. And that's good for both of us.
Absolutely. Yep. I can't thank you enough for coming on here. We always have great discussions. It's like we talk so long and we could just keep talking. Like we could literally talk about anything.
Well, unfortunately, my mother's going to be here to have lunch with me. I'm going to show off my new office and go have some lunch.
Oh, awesome. Where can they find you, Damon, across the internet?
You know, I have a Twitter handle that I never use, but I don't even know what it is. Let me look it up real quick. I know that seems silly. I think it's Damon_CK. I'm going to log in real quickly. Yes, at Damon, DAMON_CK. And maybe this will spurn me to actually start writing things on Twitter. I've been sitting on this account forever. And I don't know. I'm not much of a social media guy. But if you have something you want, send it to me there. I'll do my best to make Card Kingdom a better place for you.
Awesome. Where can they find you, Tark?
At the_Tark, T-A-R-K on Twitter. As usual, I work with QS. I also do some admin work over at the MTG Finance Central Facebook page. You can find me there, and I'm always chatting around Discord. So,
awesome. At ChazV MTG on Twitter is the best place to find me. The QS Insider Discord. If you want to hear me twice a week, I'm on the MTG Goldfish podcast alongside Seth and Richard. And you can find all my work on QS, whether it be insider or non-insider. I pretty much do it all. So, Damon, thank you again so much. We're going to have you back soon because these podcasts are always amazing.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thanks a lot,
Damon.
Thank
you very much. That's going to do it for this week and the Vendor Series cast with Card Kingdom. So that's Damon Morris for you. We will see you all next time.
See you guys. Thanks a lot.